The phrase, every good boy does fine, probably resonates with you if you took piano lessons as a kid. It was a quick way to memorize the keys on the lines of the music staff. For pianist Jeremy Denk, it's also become the title of his forthcoming memoir, which he finally had the space and the time to finish over the past few months. The book is going to be released in February, and its timing coincides beautifully with his new release of Mozart piano concertos with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. And that's the recording you're going to hear about this week on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julia Macher. Jeremy, let's start off by, let me just ask you, how are you doing? How are you?
Not too bad, considering. Yeah, I'm pretty well. I've been really enjoying, I've really started to play again more regularly, especially in September. And it feels very good to be in front of people again and to feel the kind of energy and adrenaline of performing. I'm very relieved to have finished some big projects that we'll talk about. So I'm pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm doing really well. Yeah, getting used to this groove of working out of my closet, which as I look here, I'm thinking this might need to be cleaned a little bit in here.
You get Marie Kondo over there. Yeah, she could really.
I know, but the engineers say it sounds so good that I'm hesitant to clean anything out of here. So. Jeremy, what have you discovered about yourself during the past 18 months, during the COVID lockdown and when our lives were disrupted from our routine?
Well, I wish I had really profound answers to that question. I think I discovered that I really maybe needed a vacation in a certain way from the touring life, and that it was amazing to, in a way, be in one place for a long while and sit with my thoughts and practice and have less deadlines. So I guess I discovered that about myself, that what people had been telling me for many years, that you should take a little break. And I discovered some things about, you know, my piano playing, the sort of frame of my hand and stuff about, you know, you get all these habits when you're playing a lot of concerts, and it was good to reevaluate all of that too.
Did anything come to the surface that was like, oh, this is something I really need to be focusing on?
You know, I think I'd characterize it as, I think Richter had a great quote at one point about, you know, connecting your brain to the tip of your finger. And that basically all of piano practicing is trying to shorten the distance between your brain and the tip of your finger to really feel this, you know, so that you can really enact what you want musically in sound as precisely and immediately as possible. And then all kinds of beautiful things become possible when you have that connection, when you have that energy transference that's very direct. Yeah.
Did this additional time also give you the chance to finish your book or to really fine-tune your book, or was that already in the can before the last 18 months and you were just getting ready to promote it and publish it?
You know, a lot of the book was there in various forms. The last part I hadn't really dared to finish, and then a lot of it needed editing and whittling and rethinking. And so yes, this gave me the time. My editor was so relieved, you know, that I finally had the undivided time. And I had, you know, stretches of weeks where I would just wake up and write for 3 or 4 hours, you know, and then maybe, you know, grab some food at the grocery store and then come back home and cook it. It was a very crafty time. I don't know how to describe it, you know, and there was a calmness to the routine of it. So I think one of the things that happened was I really, because of the time, I had a direct line to certain memories from the past. I was able to, you know, mull on a piano lesson from when I was 15 years old for an hour, just think, try to reconstruct it in my head. And then certain amazing moments between me and my old teachers came to me. And I sort of felt the truth of them in a way that I hadn't managed to before. And that really helped me finish the book. You know, it's like, oh yeah, this is what the book is about. It's about these intense epiphanies that happen between you and teachers, and they come at random times sometimes, and you have no idea why, but they show you something, and then all of kind of music becomes different after that.
In your forthcoming book, Every Good Boy Does Fine, you mentioned that Mozart is one of the composers who had a big impact on you. How has Mozart shaped you?
Actually, both the first and the last chapters of the book are Mozart. The first chapter is about me listening to a piece called Sinfonia Concertante when I was 12 or so. A piece that kind of rocked my world, especially one moment near the beginning where Mozart basically, in a way, destroys the frame of his own composition. He does something so outlandish and expands it so far that the music begins to grow out of its own shell. I remember that moment of music and the kind of incredible elation that it gave me. And then at the end of the book, I'm kind of recovering from some personal losses and maybe some burnout of performing and stress. And I'm about to record an album of Mozart concertos with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. And I'm trying to recover my sanity in a way. And I'm practicing these little almost nursery rhyme passages of Mozart over and over again. And I think it somehow connected me back to a childhood love of Mozart at that moment, and it felt like those passages saved me at that moment in my life. So those are Mozart is really crucial. Probably the first composer I truly loved, yeah.
You were asked recently by the director of this year's Le Mesmur Festival what music you love to play most, and you replied, Mozart piano concertos, because they make you feel free. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's a lot of different aspects of that. I'd say Mozart's often working with really, I hate to say, simple harmony patterns and very catchy bits of melody. And I often feel that Mozart acts a little bit like a jazz pianist in setting forth these little patterns and then riffing on them over and over again in different ways. And he has a kind of amazing mischievousness in the way he recasts his own material. And also, obviously, kind of an incredible profundity, you know? And he's able to pass between those two things. And I really feel that aspect of almost making it up as you go along when I'm playing Mozart concertos, more than I feel that in Beethoven concertos or, you know, obviously, like Tchaikovsky or something. It's just a different paradigm of piano playing and music making. And I think Mozart was very concerned with freedom in a way that we don't maybe talk about quite enough.
Tell me more about that.
Well, I wrote a piece for that festival in The Guardian. I wrote about, you know, how the two most famous operas of his, Don Giovanni and The Marriage of Figaro, are basically about, you know, destroying privilege, right? He wants to, they're both about noble people who are terrible and abuse their power. And he writes some of his greatest music about, you know, unmasking that power and questioning it. And I think he had a very powerful message about that in his music. His music is about that and about, he had a deep, deep attachment to, you know, non-noble people, right? People who were in a way victims. And he brought them to life in an uncanny and incredibly empathetic way.
I do want to refer to that article that you wrote for The Guardian, because you bring up something that Charles Rosen said, and you just kind of touched on that, that the entire classical style, including Mozart, depends on the style of comic opera, that art of quick-fire timing, like a comedian, and that's what helps to provide access. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, I think that's, you know, it's a kind of a music historical thing that the music in Bach, you know, you have these kind of phrases that unfold endlessly. Music just spins out in this endless continuity. And by the time you get to Mozart, you have little, almost like bites of music, you know, like one character and then another. and he's constantly switching, you know, between, as I say in the piece, you know, between the Count and then his victim, Susanna, right? And you have this sense of two people set in relation to each other, and you never feel that any particular voice in those pieces is privileged. He's able to go back and forth. And so I guess my thesis is that there's a certain empathy in Mozart, you know, an ability to chameleon-like switch from class to class, from voice to voice, from perspective to perspective. And that he gives us a certain access that you don't, you know, I think that's partly why Beethoven was not as good an opera composer. His way of providing universal access is quite different, you know. But Mozart's is, I think, a little bit more, whatever we might say, democratic. I often feel, you know, to get to Beethoven's great universal truths, you have to kind of go through Beethoven. I'm not sure I feel the same way about Mozart. Does that make sense to you at all?
Yeah. I know, I get what you're saying. Yeah. You have to be able to understand his language to get there first. Totally, yes.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's talk about the Mozart Piano Concertos on your new release with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. When was this recording made?
I think it was, if I had to say, it's either like January of 2017 or 2018. I don't exactly remember now.
Okay, yeah. So before the pandemic.
Oh, yeah, well before, yeah. It was all in the can, yeah.
Okay, gotcha. Mm-hmm. The Piano Concerto number 25 in C major, K503, is not as well known as some of the others. And you've said maybe that's because there's fewer tunes in there. Can you talk about this concerto and what it does offer that Mozart's other piano concertos maybe don't offer?
Yeah, I think it's a piece that's partly loved by musicians because it's a piece in which Mozart is subtly indulging his own curiosities and musical explorations, you know, and he's thinking a little bit less of easy accessibility. And he, you know, there is no tune at the beginning in a way. There's just like a motive. And he's in a way trying on a kind of Beethoven thing. It starts very clearly at this blaze of light in the major. You know, it's like it's going to be this sunny, grand, triumphant piece. And within like 20 seconds, it switches absolutely to this kind of terrifying C minor tragic opera of utter uncertainty. And then all through the first tutti, the first orchestral passage, you feel the music keeps switching at unpredictable intervals between these two perspectives, you know? That's something Schubert loved to do, of course, right? To kind of pull the rug under you and create this ambivalence, you know? And Mozart's really after that in this piece in a way. He does it in almost, in a way, some audiences, people might feel that the piece is unreliable in a disturbing way. It might be a little bit hard to follow. Why is this happening? I think that's part of the meaning of the piece, is why is this happening? That's what you want to address that issue as you're listening. Yeah.
You've also said that in this piece, Mozart is asking us to listen perhaps more deeply. What would you like us to be listening for, or what do you think he wants us to be listening for?
Well, I think he wants us to be listening for those changes and the kind of vulnerability that it represents, the truth about the human condition that represents, you know, this sunny facade and this dark, terrified interior. I think he also, this is really a little bit wonky, but it's very clear to me that the opening tutti, not only is he channeling a little what would become Beethoven, but he's rewriting the famous first prelude of the Well-Tempered Clavier of Bach, which is a kind of touchstone for all composers, because the first 18 bars, whatever, are all the same harmony progression as the first two bars of this famous Bach prelude. And he's really interested in the two chords, especially one particular seventh chord. And he keeps going after that beautiful, unbelievably beautiful chord again and again. Every theme, more or less every theme in the piece, visits that chord. And it's a chord that he particularly loved because it's a chord that sort of wants to direct forward. It wants to resolve to something, but not that urgently. It's sort of also interested in being its own beautiful self. So it's a chord that lives between the desire to go forward and the desire to exist in and of itself. I think he was really interested in the possibilities of that harmony and how he could expand it, and what it means in a way, to have that kind of in the last chapter of the book. I talk about in between spaces. I think that's probably what Mozart's after.
Yeah, where we aren't hearing something is just as important as where we are. In this concerto, the C major, what do you most look forward to when you're playing it?
I think my favorite moment in the piece, it has many great moments to look forward to, but my favorite moment is in the last movement, in the middle. Often Mozart and the, you know, rondos are big like sandwiches, they're big symmetrical pieces, you know, ABA, CABA, basically, a big arch structure. And usually right in the middle, in the C, he writes his best thing. And here you have this kind of love sextet, I'd say, between the piano and the winds. It's basically just three blind mice, three blind mice, three blind mice, over and over again. But he changes the chord on each blind. Three blind mice, three blind mice, three blind... And each chord is even more luscious than the last one. And we worked really hard on that with the orchestra. The winds, you know, they become kind of opera characters in their own right. The piano more or less accompanies a lot of the time, and it surrenders the spotlight to these amazing winds. It seems like a kind of almost innocent song at first, but then it takes on this unbelievable intensity, and it loops into place that you never would have expected, and it takes on an unbelievable tragedy, and then again it turns back into the light, and it begins to expand in this kind of ecstatic way. Last, it just all dissolves back to the theme. I think that transition is one of the greatest passages in all of Mozart.
As you were talking about the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra and the work that you did with them on that concerto, and on both of these, of course, what is it like? Is there a difference working with a chamber orchestra on these pieces versus a full orchestra? Or was that Mozart's intention all along?
You know, I'm not an unbelievable expert on the period style. I think Mozart did like to have big forces because they were good for concerts and making. But for me, the ideal force is not too large because there are always balance problems in Mozart concertos, especially in the modern concert hall. And then, of course, you know, it goes without saying, a lot of the people in the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra are dear friends going back now decades from music school. And so part of my chamber orchestra experience in St. Paul is this sense of a long musical friendship and a conversation that's going on, you know, and that we don't have a conductor. And Mozart probably, you know, directed these from the keyboard. That was the way this music was done for the most part. And I think that gives it the freedom that it needs for this music to speak.
Are you doing that? Do you do any conducting during these performances?
When we've done them, and you know, I sort of start the tempos, start the movements, I get things going. Every so often, if I want to instigate, I do a little waving or shaping suggestion. But mostly I let them make music because I think they like it that way and I also prefer it.
Yeah, and you know each other well enough, you're all in sync. That's awesome. The other concerto on this recording is the D minor concerto number 20, K466. And this one is a little more popular. Why do you think so?
Well, it has, you know, if I had to say, you know, even the opening orchestral passage and the one in the last movement, the first one in the last movement, are some of the most vivid, shockingly, you know, sort of iconic music that Mozart ever wrote. It's probably the same world as the famous scene when they drag the Don Giovanni down to hell. It's that D minor world, sort of unsettled, deep, deep darkness, incredible. And also maybe the Requiem a little bit, that world of Mozart in the minor key that he had such an incredible voice with. So it's that, I think what, it's partly the romantic bursting out of Mozart's, you know, Mozart's deep in the classical style, but you feel in that piece the romantic era of 30 years later just waiting to explode out.
And what is your favorite section in this concerto?
You know, I'm going to steal from my late friend Michael Friedman, who loved this piece, and I think he's right that one of the most striking passages in this piece comes in the beginning of the last movement. The piano plays the theme, and then the orchestra starts up the theme again, and usually in Mozart concertos, you know, they just repeat the theme that the piano just played. But in this case, from the second measure, the orchestra begins to develop and alter the material in a way that it's unrecognizable. It begins to like be possessed by this spirit of kind of modulation and, you know, the leaping ideal all over the orchestra pass back and forth. And I think that passage has an incredible quality that is almost unrepeated in Mozart's work.
Hearing your enthusiasm. You know, sometimes people get jaded after they've done something for a long time, and you definitely have not, so.
Yeah, no.
The other piece that's featured on this recording is Mozart's Rondo in A minor, K511. And you have said that this piece is about the nature of melancholy, a sadness about sadness. What makes you say that about this piece?
Well, Mozart wrote, you know, innumerable amazing laments, right? He wrote an unbelievable amounts of sad music, which is so beautiful. And this piece is like looping in on itself in a way. It's kind of a self-awareness. It's like a melancholy that can never be escaped, and it's kind of as you often feel when you're truly sad, you know, it begins to feed itself. It's repetitive in one way, you keep thinking over the same sad thing, but also it generates its own, you know, its own loops of thought, which are often unproductive, but you have to get through them somehow to get to the other side. I think it's connected to the way he uses this it starts with a little turn, you know, that piece. A little circle of notes. If you draw it on the page, it looks like a little loop, right? And those loops get wilder and wilder through the piece. The whorls of the melody get bigger and bigger, but they keep circling back, like any good rondo, back to the first idea, which is, you know, this kind of sense of iterative sadness.
A new recording of Mozart Piano Concertos featuring pianist Jeremy Denk with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. Since you're clearly a music fan, let me tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, The Piano Puzzler. Every week, host Fred Child invites Bruce Adolph into the studio to play one of his brilliant musical mind games. Bruce takes a familiar tune and disguises it in the style of a classical composer. Then a contestant calls in to try to solve the riddle. It's a lot of fun. If you're up for the challenge, subscribe to The Piano Puzzler wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast is New Classical Tracks, and if you're enjoying it, the best thing that you can do for the show is to tell somebody else about it, help spread the word, and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. Thanks to Valerie Kaler, our producer for New Classical Tracks. I'm Julie Amacher.